Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable, coming right to your inbox. This weekly podcast is part of our newsletter. Happy to have everybody here. Wade McFall, assistant special agent in charge, parentheses, retired, close parentheses, and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, and then the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our payment integrity director here. So we're going to talk about the topic that everybody's talking about. We're going to take a little bit of a different piece of that. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about what's gone on in New York over the past few days involving the assassination of the CEO of United. You know, the first thing I want to say is, as a New Yorker, the one thing that I think I took personal offense to was the continual trashing of New York as a city, and the crime rates of the city. The crime rates in New York City have been dropping and plummeting, and not making any political statements about the governor, the mayor, any of that. You know, there was a very quick knee-jerk reaction to this murder as a reflection of New York City and the crime rate. And it was abundantly clear from the beginning, and it has now been made more abundantly clear, right? This is a targeted assassination of the CEO of a publicly traded company. This could have happened whether it was in New York City, whether it was in Orlando, Florida, Los Angeles, Detroit, pick your city, pick your metropolitan city with a crime rate. This could have happened anywhere. It happened to be in New York City, and there's no connection between the fact that it was New York City, the crime rate, and all this. So I just put it out there because I think that we have to kind of look at it from its, you know, a little bit different perspective. So what we're not going to talk about, we're not getting into a political discussion of United and its policies and the motivation behind the shooter. We want to look at this from a little bit of a different perspective. And so, you know, part of this is this premise of public figures and threats against them, and the challenges and threat assessments, and what we would call protective operations. We're going to link this back, by the way, to SIU and payment integrity, and you're going to wonder how we're doing that. We're going to get there. But, you know, one of the things that people may not know is from, you know, in the OIG, we were all cross-trained on protective operations and provided physical security to the Secretary of HHS. Every cabinet level secretary has a protective operations group and have a dedicated team of agents. The HHS secretary is no different. The Secretary of HHS, Acting Secretary of HHS, when there is a vacancy, are provided with physical security by trained HHS OIG agents who are on permanent detail. And then agents like Matt and Wade and I provide field level supplement to the secretaries when they travel to your regional area, as well as overseas trips and things of that sort. So people that are in these cabinet level positions get very specific people to provide security. We are cross-trained. Regular training was conducted on that. Everything from driving the vehicle, advance threat assessment, threat response, all of that stuff. So you should not think that OIG agents are just out there doing the white collar stuff, getting the doctors and such. There's a whole other area that has to do with it. And so, Wade, I want to start with you because you did a ton of protection related stuff, not just in LA and not part of coordination, but you got to travel the world and do a bunch of overseas trips, which are interesting to say the least, because you're going to various places and doing these. But there are some inherent challenges. You know, the first thing that one of the things that we're learning is from the perspective of this assassination was, first of all, the UHC public, the investors meetings were being held in New York. The CEO was staying at a very large hotel in Midtown Times Square. I think that hotel is about a half a block in size or more, dozens of doors to come in and come out. probably not too much of a secret that the CEO is going to be at this investor meeting. It's publicly known. But one of the things that we have learned from the shooters, he talks about social engineering. And, you know, a big piece of social engineering in the context of healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse is the telemarketing fraud that goes on, where seniors are called and they are socially engineered into giving certain pieces of information. It is no different than the phishing, PH, spear phishing or phishing emails that come out. But a big piece of anything involving protective operations are the, you know, threat assessments and the general challenges of being in public and large groups. You know, the one thing, Wade, that always comes up is, do people know who the HHS secretary is? And the answer is sometimes, right? It's a niche thing. You know them because of some particular issue. Does everybody know who the CEO of all of the healthcare companies are? No, but if you are, if you've got a bone to pick with someone, you do. We're not talking about Elon Musk, right? Because now he's out in the public and in some different ways. But, you know, a big area in protective operation is threat assessment and the challenges of dealing with, you know, someone who's in public all the time. So talk a little bit, Wade, about, you know, over the years, some of those experiences and some of the challenges of being able to provide protection to someone who's kind of, you know, a niche person, right? Not everybody knows them, but the people that know them really know them.
Yeah. And just before I get into that part, I would point out, adding something that you said, the hotel being, you know, a half a block long, whatever, with multiple entrances. And from what I've read, the shooter arrived at the door he was going in like 5 or 10 minutes before he arrived. And it wasn't like the meeting started at 8 and he got there at 10 to 8. This was an hour and a half. This was at 6:30 or something like that in the morning. So he had to have some other thing besides just knowing that there was a shareholder meeting there to know like where he was walking and that type of thing. So there had to be some other information that he knew that he was going to get there an hour and a half before the meeting started to prep or whatever, and he knew which route he was taking. So these are the kind of things that, you know, are also important to know. But getting back to the types of things that the security teams do, another thing before I get into that is I talked to a colleague who's kind of in that field now, used to work as a federal agent doing protection. But he said right now, like, everybody is trying to get a protection detail. It's like, if you're interested in doing that kind of work, it just like quadrupled or more in the last week because everybody's trying to get a detail now. So that's what happens when an incident like this takes place. It's, you know, it's a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, well, it may be a knee-jerk reaction, but the other piece of it is that it is pretty well known that a lot of CEOs have security details already. The right. question is the knee jerk the increasing of that, or is the knee jerk that maybe there are presidents or CEOs or people out there who didn't have security that are now getting security, but it doesn't matter because now I think everybody is at an entirely different heightened level, particularly since social media has been a little aggressive in some things.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to this.
Yeah. And I read also that the CEO had a detail. It wasn't like a 24/7 detail, but he had people that were part of his protection team, but they obviously weren't with him at 6:30 in the morning on that day. But going back to the details, one of the things is, you know, it's one of the ways to look at it is you can't prevent everything. You're not just because you have a detail doesn't mean you're not, there's still going to be danger out there. I saw one of the security consultants looking at the video and he pointed out even if he had two agents with him, unless they were, you know, they could have all three gotten shot in the back. So it's the key thing there is you're really trying to harden the target. You're going to make it more difficult for them to do that or make them choose somebody else. I mean, in this case, he was a target. But if he had a very robust security detail, he may have chosen somebody other than, you know, another CEO. His beef was with the insurance business in general, probably specific to United, but if he had a great robust detail, he might have said, this isn't going to work, I'm going to go somewhere else and try and find somebody who doesn't have a detail. So that's, I think, a key point. You're not going to prevent everything, but if you have a detail that knows what they're doing and there's a presence, even, you know, if that was a detail that we would have been working, there probably would have been somebody who's obviously an agent standing at the front door there. So, you know, if he's casing the place to see if this is where he wants to make his move, if he sees agents all over and he sees the CEO walking with two or three agents in a, you know, tactical triangle or whatever, he might decide this is not the time to do this. So it's, again, it's not going to prevent everything, but it really makes it, you harden the target and it makes them kind of think twice about it.
And what you're really talking about is when you talk about hard targets and soft targets, you know, the one thing that would always raise the hair on the back of our necks was when the secretaries would come to New York and they would want to walk from their hotel to an event. And, you know, that would always raise the hair on the back of your neck, because while I would say most people during most of our time didn't necessarily know who the secretary was, the problem is that when you're wearing a suit or you're wearing dress down soft clothes and you're walking with a secretary and their spouse, you're bringing attention inherently because it's a group of four or five people surrounding this person. It's creating that environment and that presents challenges. I mean, I think at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking that's going on. Were there threats that UHC knew about? Do they have a threat assessment team? Do they have a security team? Right? You've got physical security in the buildings. We know that the buildings are pretty well secure, but, you know, ultimately, are there people in positions of authority where threats that come in, email, phone, how are they vetted? How are they addressed? How are they dealt with? Are the people that are assessing these threats the best trained people to understand these threats, right? Are they people from agencies that did a lot of that work, threat assessment, threat intelligence, and things of that sort? But it is obvious that there's now going to be an increase in the kind of security and protection that people that are in these highlighted roles get. Take it out of healthcare. You know, there's people that have a beef with climate, EPA, food. And this is why secretaries within the president's cabinet oftentimes have very robust security details, because the decisions that are made by people in these positions will have effects on the public. And it could be even, you know, when, for example, a paint company decides that they're going to add a chemical in that has a health issue, you know, there's going to be a group of people that are going to be angry about that. Climate change, whatever. When we had, for those of you that have been around a long time and remember Donna Shalala as the secretary under the Clinton administration, I remember doing details where the two biggest groups that we had problems with on events were ACT UP, which was for HIV and AIDS activism, and PETA, because of animal testing. And there are being details where, you know, on more than one occasion, we had to get her out because PETA showed up or ACT UP showed up and they were causing a ruckus at an event. And you have to get people out sooner than later. But, you know, Matt, this does get mm-hmm. to this whole kind of collateral discussion, which is, here's how we rope this back to our bread and butter in the SIU space, payment integrity. The decisions that an organization like a healthcare conglomerate makes, oftentimes it falls on the payment integrity in the SIU space, because unfortunately, look, the average person, when they have a claim denied or they find that they're not getting something covered, that average person sees that and they want to, you know, that affects them personally. And we've all experienced it. We've all had instances where we personally or have had family members who needed what somebody considered to be a medically necessary item, service, or procedure and had to go through hoops, whether it be being denied for an MRI and being told you have to go to physical therapy when you physically can't do physical therapy, and being told you have to fail physical therapy, pay all of this money out of pocket for physical therapy, then get an MRI to then, you know, go through these machinations. But from the payer perspective, and maybe to an extent the patient's perspective, the policies on payment, oftentimes, for the payer's perspective, the people that are in the forefront become the payment integrity and the SIU people, which then has this issue where perception is reality. And so you've got this kind of, you're a rock and a hard place. And we talk about payment integrity being, you know, the Mikey of the days of life cereal. Just give it to Mikey. He'll eat anything. Where we see from a lot of the work that we do in this space with a lot of our clients in the payment integrity space, that they're oftentimes dealing with a bunch of stuff that isn't even directly related to payment integrity. It's collateral, it's whatever. This actually has the potential effect of the people in payment integrity having to deal with, right, payer policies as they filter down, and the challenges from that morale perspective, the fact that payment integrity is oftentimes dealing with policies that they don't have the ability to have an investment in as part of that discussion.
Right. You look at someone like, you know, the CEO of United Healthcare. He's sort of a symbol, you know, for whoever, you know, that assassin and others that's from social media that he seemingly has pissed off. It's not something he personally did. It's just that his company anonymously made these, you know, decisions to on coverage, on for pre-authorizations, for whatever it might be. Those decisions are fairly anonymous to the public. But then they see, you know, this guy's running it all. So sort of like the hatred went to the top there. It's the same thing with secretaries of departments. They're not making all of those decisions. Those decisions are being made probably years before they were even there, and they're enforcing them. And that gets us to, you know, the SIUs and the payment integrity folks. They're the ones that are enforcing those decisions. They're the ones that are going out there and meeting with providers and meeting with the public to say, sorry, this is why we can't do it. And then, you know, quoting some policy, or for, you know, an SIU trying to get overpayments or settlements with providers who disagree with everything that is being said, but because it's coming from the insurance company, they have to abide by it. And, you know, for the people in the SIU and the payment integrity folks, there's not a lot of joy in that work. You know, every day they're making somebody angry. And they are then the real face of that decision, because you're having face-to-face direct contact with the person that decision is affecting. So, you know, that's why, you know, OIG agents, when we were there, you know, we would get death threats, you know, we, and SIU, when I was working the SIU with the UPIC, you know, we were receiving threats, you know, from folks in, you know, the New York area where we were working, not to believe, you know, not to say anything bad about New York, but it was, it was some of the dangerous areas in New York. You know, we were getting threats when we would go on site to talk to these providers. And it is, you know, it is somewhat thankless. But, you know, when looking at some of the SIUs and program integrity things, you brought it up, you know, it's the dumping ground. You know, they're handling everything from potential criminal cases where it's false claims to enrollment issues or coverage issues that should be handled by someone else, or compliance issues with everything kind of gets dumped on these folks. And then they become the face of the big bad insurance company that's making these decisions and enforcing them. And that's what, you know, it kind of just brings it home as to, you know, this assassination of Mr. Thompson, that's a symbol of the anger in this country and things like that. But on a day-to-day basis, we live that every day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, I would always say to people, you know, as an OIG agent, every day you went to work, your goal and it's kind of raw to say this, but your goal is to ruin someone's day,
yeah.
right? We're doing criminal, civil, administrative cases, whether their day is being ruined by ultimately them being arrested or a civil case being put against them for millions of dollars or an administrative case where exclusion might be on the table or payments being made, you know, back to the program. You know, it's not a happy day. It's like getting that bill for, you know, it's like getting an electric bill that's $1,000 and you saying, I don't even know, how do I have $1,000? You know, it's just, you don't expect it. It's just, it ruins your day. It's the bad news. In the payment integrity space, it's really not that dissimilar. You know, at the end of the day, there's that balance of not ruining someone's day to the point where the provider wishes to pull out of the network or do whatever, but that balance of enforcing a policy that you didn't have any say in the creation or formulation. I mean, we know CMS comes up with policies all the time. The HHS secretary does not approve every policy that CMS comes out with. It just doesn't happen. The CEO of a large publicly traded company doesn't approve every single policy that's out there. In fact, I would be pretty amazed if you were to go through and ask the CEO of any company if they could list their top 10 payment methodologies, whatever it may be. I think you'd have a very hard time finding a CEO who can kind of get to that level of granularity on things, just because it's not at that level. It doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. Again, we're just talking about the fact that, you know, this was a symbolic assassination. While it could have been directly relating to this guy's, you know, now we're learning that he may have had a spinal fusion and some back surgeries. He might have been covered by United at the time. He might have had some issues with getting the payments. Those are all things I think that are going to kind of come out. Those are really his motivation, which you can never justify, right? It may explain his motivation, but it doesn't really, you know, justify it. But it certainly is, from our perspective, it shows two things. One, that we have now entered a new phase in the world of corporate security. So unfortunately, another sector of our lives are demonstrated to be less safe. And it is, you know, because this, you know, this guy took issue with the decisions of a company and made it a personal thing. But it also goes to demonstrate that the lower level people, you know, your SIU, your payment integrity people, are often held to blame for things that they have no control over. They're just cogs, you know, kind of just cogs in that wheel, you know, as not being decision makers, but being decision carrier outers, right? Because they're just part of that. I think we're going to learn a lot more about what went on there. Obviously, the evidence is starting to pile up on these things, forensically and otherwise. The ghost gun, for example, and the ballistics on that, some other DNA, some other, you know, documents, I think, that they're finding. We haven't heard about search warrants being executed at his house or any other location. I think those are probably going to be next on the list. Now that they've identified who he is, I think we're going to see some things that are going to be coming about from, you know, search warrants of his email and text messages and things of that sort. So I think we've unfortunately entered a new phase of life with the way that CEOs are viewed. And unfortunately, the fact that we're seeing some pretty strong feelings in social media about corporate leaders, good, bad, or indifferent, I think mostly bad, unfortunately. But it is interesting how, when we start to look at these things, how we see that these things percolate down to even, you know, to the lowest level of things. So wait, I want to give you the last piece of this. You know, one of the things that we know from our days of dealing with the secretaries is that oftentimes decisions made by others have an effect on those around you. You know, from that protective operations piece, you know, what are some of the things that that people need to really think about? And, you know, we've already talked a little bit about social engineering, but, you know, When it comes to threat assessment and things like that, what are a couple of things out there that people in leadership positions need to be thinking about when it comes to getting in these kind, you know, when you get this kind of information? And I do think this is one of those examples where that law enforcement liaison role does have that that ability to percolate outside of the SIU space.
Well, I think one of the kind of common themes that we would see is you would have a certain number of threats that you would consider credible threats, but thankfully and luckily, most of the time, 99 times or 900 times out of 1,000, nothing happens. So then when you're trying to get resources and you're trying to get more people and saying, oh, we need 15 people for this, you know, day that we're having two or three events, and the people with the checkbook, you know, theoretically are saying we can't afford those kind of resources. The threats really haven't come through. And it's like, we can probably get by with half of those people. We just need one person at each site, that type of thing. And until something happens, then it changes the game. But it's difficult to kind of convince maybe, I don't say upper management, but people that aren't involved with the detail itself, that maybe haven't worked a detail. They don't understand why you need so many people, you need so many vehicles. You know, you need to have five people staying overnight at the hotel that the secretary's at when they want you to just drive home and go back in the morning. It's like that breaks kind of this, you know, security protocol. And people that really haven't been involved with it don't understand all the resources that are really necessary for that one time when something might happen. Or, as I said earlier, if it's having that presence there might prevent something from happening, just because they see all these agents with the earpieces in and walking around. It's like, this is a very secure place and I'm not going to mess with it, as opposed to having one kind of incognito undercover agent there just in case something happens. Depending on the circumstances, sometimes you want a very obvious presence, and maybe there might be times, like you said, walking downtown New York or any major city, if you have a prime, you know, somebody that you're protecting that's maybe not as known, you know, everybody doesn't know who they are. If you have a bunch of people with suits, you're going to bring attention to that. If you have them dressed down, maybe you want to be incognito. So it depends on the detail. But I really think it's a matter of going back to there's a lot of threats. Thankfully, most of the time, nothing happens. Nothing comes through with them. It's at least nothing, you know, serious like this one. You might have somebody who wants to shout at some kind of meeting. They want to disrupt it. That's not too serious compared to when someone's going to be hurt or killed. So it's just a matter of having all those resources, like we talked about recently, even on law enforcement activities, you need to have more resources than you think you're going to need, because you're expecting the unexpected. Same thing goes with the threats. They're probably not going to come through, but you need to be ready for them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot more that's going to come out on this. I think there's going to be a lot of ongoing discussions. I'm really hoping that the rhetoric gets tamped down as the next coming weeks come through. I think it just needs, there's a lot of rhetoric about a lot of things, and I think this is just another one of those that needs to kind of get tamped down. You know, obviously, the assassination, and, you know, we can't condone it. But it's obviously opened people's eyes up to maybe collaterally a greater, you know, issue in the healthcare industry that people, you know, weren't really willing to address. But for the payment integrity and the SIU people, just keep doing what you're doing. You know, you got to just keep doing what you're doing. You're the stewards of the dollar. And, you know, again, not good, bad, or indifferent about how those dollars are paid. But from the SIU perspective, you have a job to do. Hold the course, and, you know, and keep on where you're going. Maybe this will result in changes in policies. Maybe it won't. We'll have to see. But as always, these are sometimes, you know, I think we struggled a lot with whether or not this was a topic we wanted to address. But and I don't want to say we jumped on the bandwagon to discuss it, but it's something that's out there. I think we look at it from a little bit of a different perspective than others. And so we hope that everybody who's watching this kind of sees that we looked at this from a little bit of a different perspective. So as always, we appreciate everybody taking the time to tune in and spend some time with us. And again, join us every week for our OIG roundtables. We've got some great LinkedIn Lives coming up in the next few months. You'll see some really good ones. We've got some pretty cool guests we're going to be bringing on pretty soon. Some are people that you know. Some are people that we hope you'll get to know. And we'll hopefully have some really good conversations with people. Again, you can get the weekly OIG Roundtable podcast brought to you in your newsletter, Spotify, and our YouTube channel. So tune in, enjoy them, and we'll see you all next week on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you.